Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Up Your Brave show with Natalie Cutler-Welsh here on Reality Check Radio. Next up, we're going all the way over to Australia. I'm going to be talking to Emma Beatty on setting a place at the table for grief. Welcome to the show, Emma.
Thank you so much for having me, Natalie.
For those of you that may not know Emma, Emma has worked, studied, and volunteered in caring and deathing since 2020. She brings an animistic, creative, and poetic lens to caring, deathing, and grieving. I haven't heard that phrase before. Her death and dying work, ongoing education, intersect a long line of personal loss. She offers practical support, education, and facilitation for people, families, and groups through term courses, workshops, community meetups, and retreats. Her professional origins sit in strategic thinking, storytelling, and social impact. Emma is a member of Palliative Care and New South Wales and the Natural Death Advocacy Network and an advocate for Compassionate Communities Australia. Emma is part of a wave of people and movements dedicated to social justice and change in the way that we care, die, and grieve. She actively participates in reimagining how people, communities, and workplaces can prepare, adapt, and respond to the more challenging parts of being human, which she says are too often left untended. Emma advocates that it is vital, necessary, and life-giving to create spaces and places for our humanity to be expressed so we live in integrated wellness. Oh my goodness, Emma, that is so good. I wanted to dive into a few of those things, including what do you mean by integrated wellness? So I'll put that in my back pocket. But before we dive in, can you give us a little bit more backstory? How did you come to be somebody who empowers and supports people in this area of grief and loss?
Thank you for the question. I discovered in my life that I just felt really inept at being able to be with people that I loved in challenging times. And I thought I really need to skill up. And so I started reading, and the readings just stuck. It wasn't like, you know, it goes in and then it comes out. And I just thought, this is incredible. This is so human. And this is so real and pure and honest work. And one thing led to another. And I started studying and training and applying myself in a volunteer capacity, home hospice service. And it just grew until in the last 12 months, it's kind of just really taken me, you know, into new territories and has enabled me to really apply the learnings.
It's so refreshing to hear you say that, you know, in a way that you were inept. A lot of us do. A lot of us feel inept or unqualified, unskilled. I love your phrase about skilling up in this area of supporting people and even holding space for people who are going through some sort of grief like that. What are the types of grief? Because obviously death is something that comes to mind when I think of grief, but I know it's not just that. What are some types of grief that we might be encountering in our lives?
I mean, grief is omnipresent and we don't weave it into our everyday. It's something that we see as an unwelcome guest. And what I was noticing at the bedside was, you know, all of these different griefs coming to the surface of lives that, you know, were being questioned. Have I loved enough? Have I been loved enough? And have I done enough? And have I given enough? And what is my legacy? And, you know, so I was meeting grief at the bedside and through home hospice and through people I was caring for. You know, sometimes I would see grief out in the street and I would notice the awkwardness of people witnessing. It's kind of seen as inconvenient and awkward, but it's very present in day-to-day conversations. You know, it's in our text streams, it's in relationship malfunction or rupture. You know, there's ecological change and species extinction genocide, you know, deception, aging parents, empty nest. You know, there's a recognition as we kind of embark on, you know, meet ourselves in middle age where we go, you know, what has my life been about? And so grief, yeah, it's everywhere. It permeates our lives, and yet we turn the other way. We don't lean in. And I guess what I'm trying to raise awareness of is, let's lean in. Let's invite it to the table. Let's come into right relationship with how grief presents, you know, see what wants to be known.
I don't know if you termed the phrase, but I love the phrase, invite it into the table. And I'm seeing, you know, so it brings a picture to mind of a dining room table and different seats and plates. Would you say that regret is maybe one of the seats at the table? Like, is that naturally an integrative part of the grief experience?
Yeah, I think this is what we forget because we live in binaries, and grief is so complex and so nuanced, and it shows up all kinds of ways. And this idea of inviting grief to the table enables us to sit in a kind of spaciousness, in a relational spaciousness, with all of the parts of grief that come up. You know, there might be deep sorrow, there might be rage, there might be a quietude that's required, you know, an overwhelm, a frustration, you know, there's so much, you know, if you think about, you know, joy can be a part of grief too, you know, and I think about sitting with grief at the table amongst all of these other emotions, and joy is like a child under the table tickling the toes of the guests, you know, and there's room for all of it. There's room for all of those emotions, everything that comes when we sit at the table with our grief.
Joy is interesting, isn't it? Because to me, that brings to mind, if someone is feeling joyful, then they feel like, oh, I shouldn't be joyful because I'm supposed to be sad. Like, we put all these rules in place, and it's like they should push that emotion aside because they should really feel the other ones, the lower vibration, or the, you know, sorrow that you mentioned, the rage, the regret. So I love that. There's so many different places at the table. Is there one that's more common or not so much? It really is individual.
It's so personal. It really, you know, if we talk about the loss of somebody, then it really depends on your relationship to that person, you know, your relationship to death, you know, how many times have you experienced the loss of somebody, you know, how that person died, you know, there's so many different elements to loss. And so every time we meet with it, it shows up differently. You know, even when we do our work around grief, even when we think that we are practiced and we are literate, something comes along and just skittles us. Even with literacy, it's hard.
There's two things I'd love to revisit from your bio that were so intriguing to me. One is a term I hadn't heard before. So it says here, Emma has worked, studied, and volunteered in caring and deathing since 2020. What is deathing?
I guess it's, you know, it's a verb. It's doing death and doing it in a way that is honest and community focused and in keeping with the person and the family and friends that surround that person. It really means participation to me. To me, that's how I would frame it. It's deathing feels participatory, and we've lost that skill. We outsource everything, and we need to reclaim how we do end of life and how we companion end of life and how we care for our dead, because what the research shows is that it mitigates the impacts of complex grief significantly.
Let's talk more about the companion piece, because again, that might be a new phrase for people. So how do we, I'm trying to remember the exact word you used. How do we do the companion piece to really honor people going through that death experience?
Yeah, we listen. We don't know or assume to know, you know, and we ask questions, you know, what matters to you now? What is important, and how can I connect the dots to enable you to be with what matters most? And, you know, often at the bedside, you know, there are a lot of stories that come out, you know, because people's worlds get smaller and smaller. You know, people are busy and you think that we have really amazing networks of care, but I read somewhere that it takes around 16 people to care for somebody at home when they're dying. And that's, you know, specialist palliative care, which is, you know, community care, friends, family. It might be allied health care or holistic health care. It might be pets. But, you know, a larger network is required in order to do that sustainably, because otherwise what we find is burnout for carers.
I actually interviewed, this is last year, I interviewed Jackie O'Connor. For those of you listening, you might have heard that interview. She's from Heart Place Hospital, and she actually cares for the carers, because it is so easy for carers who are natural nurturers. And I would say, without putting a label on it, that you seem to me, just even the softness of your voice, right? You feel to me like such a natural, nurturing person. And I've only just met you now. But it's so easy for people to have what is termed, you might have heard this, generosity burnout, where it's give until they fall into a heap on the floor. It's so important to realize, like you said, I didn't realize it would take so many people to help somebody through that end of life journey. I love that question that you highlighted that people ask usually near the end. And wouldn't it be great if we asked ourselves this question before that time? You know, what matters most to me, and really lived our life from that energy? What are your comments on that?
Oh, thank you for saying that, because it's something that is really, really important. And Stephen Jenkinson talks a lot about this, particularly in the, you know, in the end of life space. He talks about, you know, that if when we receive a life-limiting diagnosis, why are we surprised? You know, because really, if we're rooted in our lives, this is not going to come as a huge surprise. You know, that we think death is some kind of surprise is surprising. We are born, and the cycle of life means we're going to die. You know, when that is, we don't know. So this idea of weaving death into life is pivotal for our vitality and for us to live the fullness of our humanity. And, you know, I explain it often as we go life, death. And it's life, death, life, death, life, death, life, death. I say to people, look in your fruit bowl. Is there something moldy in there? What's in the bottom of the fridge? Like, you know, always. Is there a carrot at the back? You know, we cut the flowers and we put them on the table and they die, and we put them on the compost, hopefully not in the rubbish. And everything is in these cycles, and we live with this daily, but we don't live with death daily. We turn and run. It's too hard, and we outsource it, and we're missing a trick, because this brings so much vitality and presence to the way that we live, the way that we encounter nature, the way that we encounter our children, the way that we encounter our parents and our neighbors and our friends. And when there is a death, it's a real shake-up, you know, it's really jarring. And then what happens is all of a sudden you get this new lease on life, like life is in hypercolor, it's like kaleidoscopic all of a sudden. And you get in this kind of hypersensitivity space, and you really start reflecting, and it's, why aren't we living like this? Why do we wait? If we really truly presenced each other, knowing that our time was finite, it's very different. It's a very different way to live.
It's such a fusion, isn't it, between realizing that death is natural and a cycle, your example with the fruit bowl and the carrot in the fridge, and then also this human nature aspect of, why does it take tragedy in order for us to really live life and cherish the moments, the kaleidoscope living? I don't know. It's just the kind of the way that we roll. It almost takes a near-death experience, right? Or a scare or a tragedy for us to really appreciate that. I'd love to ask you a little bit more, going back to your bio, about integrated wellness. What do you mean by that term? Because I think that sounds like such an amazing place to be. For us to, as you said, to create spaces and places for our humanity to be expressed, so we live in integrated wellness. What does that look like?
Well, I think we've been sold a bit of a Disney untruth. You know, we are sold this kind of positive culture of living a happy life. And if we're not happy, then somehow we're failing. And it's not true, you know, and life is so fast and it's so busy and we juggle all the things. And in grief, we don't take the time to tend it. We don't take the time to be compassionate to ourselves. You know, we are told, wow, you know, she's really strong in this. And, you know, she really has it together and look at her, you know, back at work and wow. And it might just mean that we don't have the language for it and we're not really metabolizing what is actually going on. You know, because we're living this happy life. And so when we talk about integrated grief, it's living alongside grief, it's wearing our grief and it's tending it, it's paying attention and noticing, you know, body scan, how do I feel today? What are the tight bits? Am I short of breath? Am I stressed out? What's coming up for me? Or, you know, what news have I just had that's triggered something else? And so it's really about integrating grief with life, but also integrating with community too, integrating with the natural world, remembering our place in the order of wild things, you know, integrating a kind of kinship with things. We've forgotten how to do that. So when I talk about integration, it's how can we live with death and with loss and with grief in ways that feel generative.
For those people listening, I love that concept of a body scan. Maybe do a quick body scan yourself. Go through your, just feel into your body. How do you feel? Is there anything that's happened recently that's thrown you off? Maybe it's surprised you. Just really noticing instead of, I imagine what most people do, right? They wake up, turn on their phone, look at their to-do list, something like that.
Yeah. And Michael Meade says, you know, slow and down are movements of the soul. And so, you know, when he talks about that, it's this idea of bringing your butt to the earth and really being held. I mean, no one holds us like the great mother, right? You know, Mother Earth, this is what I hear from people. You know, if I'm in my grief, I feel like I'll be swallowed, like the ground will give way and open up and I will be swallowed and I don't know how I will recover. So feeling into our bodies and really coming into connection with the earth, we are held.
Do you find that people do, they try to avoid things? I mean, going through grief or loss, either your own or someone else's, some people, they don't know what to say, so they say nothing. Do you have any guidance for anyone listening that might want to support someone in their life who is going through a hard time or actually a grief or a loss? What is one way we can help to support our friends or family?
By just being there, by creating small, you know, kind of microcosms of grief communities, you know, by having the conversation beforehand, by upskilling our grief literacy, you know, just keeping company and not needing to fix, just accompanying, you know, companioning the grief and to normalize how it shows up. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about that it's awkward and that it's inconvenient, or, you know, there's a lot of fear and grief that there's going to be this eruption, you know, a big emotional outburst and how embarrassing or how shameful or inconveniencing others. And I think to create safe containment for what we can't contain ourselves. So it doesn't need to look like a big group therapy situation. You know, I attend groups, community grief tending, and that is really rich and beautiful work. But you can do that in a group of two or three. I had recently friends of mine came to my table and we did a small ritual to acknowledge the loss of some shared friends. And it was a little bit awkward, you know, and so we need to strengthen the muscle of being with and creating that safe containment to hold whatever comes up. And that, I think that doesn't just apply to grief, that just applies to relational being, you know, with each other, to pay attention, to notice, to say it's all okay, because, you know, it comes in and it goes, it comes in, it's alive, you know, these emotions are alive.
Some of my listeners know that I recently started working at a local community center working with the elderly. Because I was desiring in my life more personal connection. I mean, in-person connection. I get to do a lot online, but it's quite a different experience in real life. And just a few weeks back, one of the guys, you know, I was like, how are you going? And he's like, I'm surviving. And I said, oh, you know, wouldn't it be great if you were thriving? And we kind of have this joke that every time he comes in, it's like, he's not allowed to say he's surviving. He's you know, trying to say something else. But anyway, one day he did come in with teary eyes and he had a bit of a chat with one of the women. And I said, oh, how are you? He said, oh, I'm really missing my wife. Oh, when did she die? 8 years ago. So here's the thing. It doesn't just go away. Something will happen. You'll hear a song, you know, you'll have a conversation. You'll see someone that reminds you, or someone will be wearing something or a perfume or whatever. And like, we just had this moment and I didn't know if it was appropriate, but I gave him a hug. And then I almost started crying. Like I was kind of doing that thing where I was blink, 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 because I just was feeling his pain. And I think just for him to be acknowledged, like it wasn't like me just avoiding it. I said, oh, you know, I really feel for you. And I gave him a hug. And I don't imagine he gets a lot of hugs these days. I don't really know. But it was quite a beautiful moment in a very sad way.
This is the connection that grief is a leveler. You know, it doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter, you know, it's not, you know, privilege doesn't protect you from grief. This is really honest and pure work. And this is what we can do for each other and with each other as human beings. It's the work of being human. And the connections and the bonds are so strong. That's a moment that you will carry and that you will share probably for quite some time, and that had meaning for the both of you. And so this is the beauty of when you come together with others to share, to create that holding space, you know, that containment for sharing. It is so beautiful and so bonding. And this is what we are hungry for. Mm. We are lonely, and grief is a really lonely process. Even, you know, when we're around lots of people, you know, we might go back to work. I think bereavement leave is like 2 or 3 days, you know, something happened, you know, we lose someone and we go back to work, and there's no kind of place and space to share what you shared with this man, you know, because people find it really awkward. So the more that we can love each other, the more that we can create containment for our watery bodies. You know, this amazing work by Astrida Nemanis, and she talks about bodies of water, and our 75% body of water is, you know, sloshing around in our grief. And if we get leaky, it's good to know that there's a bigger body of water. So whether that's another 75% body of water in person, or maybe that's the lake or the river or the ocean, it's, you know, we need something to contain us that is bigger than us when we're grieving.
I think the power of, as you call it, getting leaky is underestimated, because I think in our society, we're so encouraged, I suppose, for soldiering on, right? You know, 3 days off, bereavement leave. Oh, look at her. She's, you know, you're doing so great. You're back at work. Good on you. You know, and it kind of gets reaffirmed. But what doesn't happen is people don't really get the opportunity to continually or allow that grief to come and go as it does in waves. It doesn't just like come and done.
Mm-mm. There's a beautiful model by Lois Tonkin, and it shows how grief is like this ball, and it's in a jar, and the ball doesn't get smaller, but the jar gets bigger. And it's, you know, this idea that we just grow around the grief. We wear it, you know, I've heard it described as being a coat. We walk with so many griefs in our life. And there's a really beautiful, beautiful poem called Kindness by Danusha Lamaris. And in that she says, before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow is the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. We all carry grief, you know, as you know, Francis Weller talks about this kind of fidelity to grief, because he knows now in his 70s that the one sure thing in life is that grief is here, and you know, we will be constantly met by grief. And so there's a trusting in a way that we can have with grief, because it just is part of our human experience. And he says, don't miss it. Don't miss it, because even though it's unwelcome, it comes bearing gifts.
That reminds me of, I was recently interviewed on another show on RCR, Jerry Pives, who has the show, The Psychotherapist's Chair. And it was a bit of a turning the tables, because instead of me interviewing someone, I was being interviewed. And Jerry's, if you guys haven't listened, Jerry's shows are really long. His interviews are an hour. And then we provide 7 songs, and each song is from a certain age or stage in our life, you know, pivotal memory, and we explain why it's important to us. So it was about a 2-hour experience. It was like therapy. It was beautiful. And one of the questions he asked was around, you know, what makes you tick, or what gets you through the day? What gets you through the day? And what gets you through the hard times in your life? And I said, just knowing that we are here to learn and grow. And for me, like, that's the thing. And I said, you know, life is like a sushi train, and it serves us up in invitations and opportunities to learn and grow. Some of them we choose. We're like, oh yeah, I'll do that. That, you know, I'll travel here, or I'll do that course, or I'll, you know, and other ones we don't choose. Life presents them to us, but there's always opportunity to learn and grow. And I feel like grief is intertwined with that. What are your thoughts on that, on the sushi train and the opportunity to learn and grow, and grief and sorrow that comes with it?
Oh, well, I love the metaphor, you know, of food when we talk about grief, because there's some kind of hospitality, there's a generosity in thinking about grief and the metaphor of, you know, Bayo Akamalafe says, when grief comes, give her something to eat. And I love that, you know, it's so generous, it's so spacious, it's like a homecoming, it's mm-hmm. inclusive, there's a sense of belonging. And when I was a child, I used to pack a lunch and cycle down to the cemetery and eat my lunch with the souls down wow. in the cemetery and the grasses. And for me, it was a very, very peaceful experience. And as I got older and a bit more, you know, weathered, you know, a number of storms, I would have this visualization of being a small child and sharing my lunch with what was hard. So I didn't know it at the time, but what I was doing was I was creating separation from what was difficult so that I could come into relationship with it. And often with grief, you know, we keep it over there. And in coming into relationship, it allows us to tend it. It allows us to love it, because grief and love are twins, right? They're inextricably linked. And I think sometimes in the depths of despair, in the depths of our sorrow, we forget about the love. You know, there isn't room for love. Stephen Jenkinson talks about grief and gratitude going hand in hand, and not just the gratitude for what benefits us, but the gratitude for what is challenging us too. If we talk about the cycle of things, you know, a marriage coming to the end, how do we practice gratitude for the full cycle of that? You know, if we think about the blooms that we bring to the table for our grief, if they're spring blooms, then those bulbs know the season of wintering before they bud and bloom. And we wouldn't know the beauty of those blooms, of those flowers, without that bulb knowing, you know, without knowing the darkness. But even under the darkness, this is what I really love, even under the darkness, those roots are pushing, are met with resistance from the soil, and they're going down whilst, you know, it's trying to push its way through the earth to the light. You know, it's both ways. We don't just get the happy life. It's everything is cyclic.
I love it. I'm really seeing it now, this metaphor, this visualization of the table, and there's a place, and what you said before about when grief shows up, give her something to eat, I think is what you said. And I think that'll shift massively. I think some of our listeners, text us and let us know if this is resonating for you. If hopefully, my hope and intention is that from today's interview, from this conversation, that it gives you a different perspective, maybe not tips and skills as such, but more like a different perspective when grief does show up at your table. Instead of saying, sorry, we're full, there's no plate for you. Instead, you do set a place and you give her something to eat and you honor that experience, which is all part of your journey. You can send us a text, 2057, or if you're more into email, inbox@realitycheck.radio. I've got a question, Emma, about tending, grief tending. What is one sentiment that you hear time and time again in your grief tending work?
If I start to cry, I might not stop.
People say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what, they've just been like basically damming up the waterfall for so long?
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned it before, this beautiful man in the aged care facility, you know, 8 years ago. I hear griefs of 20, 30, 40 years of grief, of holding, of holding. It's heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is so much fear around coming into relationship, touching what is so tender. And this is the beauty of doing this work together, you know, with your two or three people, mm-hmm. or with your community or your wider family or your chosen family, is that we hold each other. We create a container larger than ourselves to hold us, welcoming what wants to be known.
Do you find in that instance they are able to give themselves permission to cry, or do they keep holding it in?
I guess it depends on the individual. You know, there's also a real sort of generational thing. I find that the millennials are much more willing to go into these places. You know, they do their financial fitness, they do their mindfulness fitness, you know, they do their holistic sexuality fitness, you know, and they want to do their death fitness and their grief fitness. You know, there's this well-roundedness that I notice in younger generations, this capacity, this will for growth. But it's, you know, when you sort of start to, you know, middle-aged, the boomers and above, it's very, very difficult. But the beautiful thing I find in grief is that it creates pathways for conversations for death.
Mm-hmm.
And those conversations, those essential conversations around getting your end-of-life paperwork done, you know, acknowledging what your wishes are, having a number of people know what is important for you. You know, those conversations can be very, very hard to have later in life, and especially following a diagnosis. So grief, I think bringing grief, allowing grief to come into the room is a really useful pathway for having end-of-life conversations.
And that's right. And the end of life is just part of it. As you mentioned before, it might be a relationship that comes to an end. You know, maybe for someone it's a job that they didn't, that, you know, they've been in for 20 years and all of a sudden it comes to an end and there's grief because who am I without this job title and who am I without this income? So what other shapes and sizes does grief come in?
We touched on a little bit, you know, ecological grief and, you know, in this time where we have significant species loss, particularly in Australia, we had bushfires, we had floods, you know, natural disasters, you know, people's homes and belongings. We have grief around what we believed we were worthy of receiving and didn't. You know, we reach this kind of middle point of our lives and we think, oh, this is not what I thought it was. I thought that I would, you know, have five children, or, you know, I thought that I would be at this point in my career. And, or, you know, my parents said that I should go in this pathway and actually I'm not happy, in that kind of rupture of self, you know, of kind of disbelief. What has happened? Where has my life gone? You know, there's so many, you know, when we talk about, you know, what's happening in Palestine, you know, I mean, this is overwhelming, the streams and streams and streams of, you know, media and people just in disbelief. What do I do with this?
Exactly, because it can be so overwhelming if you actually look at the world like that, you know, going, there are so many tragedies and travesties at the moment. You could just live 24/7 in grief. How can we make sure that we don't do that?
With gratitude. And I don't mean, you know, kind of airy-fairy woo-woo gratitude. I mean deep-hearted, holistic gratitude and knowing that grief comes with love. You know, we don't mourn for these families and for our kindreds in Gaza without loving, without caring deeply. And that capacity for love is so spacious, it's so generous, it's so big. You know, it's not, we don't grieve in isolation. You know, we're griefers, lovers. So we allow ourselves the spaciousness and the kindness and the compassion to feel, knowing that we get to feel because we love and care so much.
That's such an important point to make. Were they the sisters that you mentioned before? Love and grief are sisters.
Yeah.
Are also anger and sadness sisters? Brothers, maybe?
anger is really complex. You know, it's like a it's like an iceberg.
I mean, is it part of the grief process?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. There's a whole lot of holy outrage. You know, you feel ripped off, ripped off. You know, you lose, let's say, you know, you lose your beloved partner of, you know, 30 years, you know, there's holy outrage. Like, how dare this happen to me? And because of the way that we live, separated from loss and separated from death, even more so. And it's multifaceted. It might be, you know, well, why do all the people in my life leave? You know, why do they all die? Or I didn't have a great relationship with my parent, for instance. And, you know, there's so much stuff that was unsaid. Or, you know, it's anger comes from so many different places. And I see it and I experience it. And it's, I think the trick is to allowing it to be, and to be in containment and to be held in safety so that you can feel that. Mm-hmm. You can be it. You can work with it. And Porges talks about, you know, kind of working beyond these emotions, you know, paying attention to it, staying curious to what arises, and knowing that these things are transient. You know, you're not going to stay angry your whole life if you compassionately tend what presents, what comes up.
Yeah, I mean, I often think of anger, well, these days, the old me would have been like, oh, I shouldn't feel angry. Other people have it worse. You know, life is good. You know, try to put the positive spin on. And the new me right now, I just go, thank you, universe, for showing me I'm out of alignment. Where am I saying yes when I really mean no? That's anger. Or where am I not being listened to or not being heard? And possibly where am I not really saying what I want? So it's not that someone's not listening. It's that I'm not speaking. Because a lot of people, they keep the anger inside and the sadness. You know, they might bottle it. And then it presents as health problems quite often. So I love that you're really expressing us, coming back to the topic. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking to Emma Beattie today about setting a place at the table for grief. And I think that really is such a simple and beautiful strategy for people. And it's something people can remember. I mean, for me, I'm a big visual. So I would visualize like a family dining room table. Well, probably the table I've got upstairs, and setting a place and honoring that and not pushing it away, but in fact, serving part of the meal to the grief at the table. Emma, I would love to ask you, I'm going to ask you the Up Your Brave question, but first I wanted to do a little shout out for your mom. How did you come to be a guest on the show?
So I think my mom came into connection with one of your producers, and she was talking to them about my work, and they said, oh yeah, well, she should really talk to Natalie.
Yeah. I love that. You know, we do have people approach us, and they do a great job at matchmaking, right? The right guest for the right show. And of course you could go on many shows. I can definitely see you going on Breakfast. So we might get you back talking to Paul, but, I think it's so great. It's so great that your mom is a listener. She's an RCR fan and she suggested her daughter for the show. I think that's so great. If you were to truly up your brave for the remaining months of 2024, what would you do?
Oh, well, my growth spot right now is public speaking. I dusted off my public speaking training wheels. Again, it had been about a decade, so I've been in the thick of parenting. And it had been a long time since I did public speaking. And so that makes me feel brave. More public speaking gigs, because this feels really important to keep the caring, dying, grieving conversation very much alive.
Well, you are a natural to me. I mean, I consider being interviewed is part of public speaking. People often would think of public speaking as someone by themselves standing in front of a room, which is often what it looks like, but it doesn't have to. I consider it sharing your wisdom. I also feel that every person has wisdom to share with the world. They might not feel called to do that. But thank you for having the courage, upping your brave, even to do this interview. And it's been very easy for me as a host. You know, you're very, very natural. You're very comfortable. You're very wise. And I'm really looking forward to hearing people's thoughts on what they've taken away from today. What is coming up for you in the next few months? And how can people reach out or follow you or connect with you online?
Oh, thank you. Online, my website is beforeandafterlife.com.au. Coming up, I have some, I'm collaborating with a beautiful fiber artist, and we're running some in-person workshops exploring caring, dying, and grieving.
What is a fiber artist?
Oh, she works with fiber. So, weaving nature. So my colleague Zimmy, she goes out, she forages cat's claw, which is a weed, and she forages it, works with it, prepares it, and then she creates coffins out of this weed. And so, yeah, she works with different, all kinds of different fibers.
Amazing.
To make basketry, to make objects, to create vessels. She's amazing. Check Zimmy out. And it's a very ecological, it's a very sustainable option for people, you know, looking to do things for, in a green way at the end of life.
Mm-hmm.
But also just, yeah, the process of making. I could talk a lot.
Very therapeutic, isn't it? Because it's tactile, it's hands-on, and you're conversing while you're making, I imagine.
Right. And, you know, the thing about working with your hands is haptic perception is that you're working with the whole body and coming into, you know, a communal setting, working together, the sharing, the depth of, I mean, this is old stuff, you know, like there's an old remembering of how to be together when you come together and make. It's very primal and ancient and really special experience. So we have a series of three workshops. I'm running a term program that starts in about a week's time. And I'm hoping to come to New Zealand in the summer, actually, and run some sessions. We have Dying to Know Day is coming up in August. So we have some community, a community day then.
Is that something that you've created, or is that more of a, is that an Australian thing?
That's an Australian thing, and it enables people in communities to create experiences for people to come to get closer with death and dying. It's, you know, we have all these questions and places to be able to ask them. Just starts to enter you into a relationship, you know, and when you come into relationship, then you have the opportunity to live with more vibrancy, with more vitality. So that's what's coming up. An online program is on the cards starting in September. A lot of people have been asking me to do things online. So I've said towards the end of September, an online program will come online.
Well, it sounds like you've got some amazing things going on to really support people through this journey, something that obviously relates to everybody. I can see that you're also on Instagram, so I'll read that out. On Instagram, it's Before and After Life. So it's Before and A-N-D, After dot Life. And then you're also on Facebook. I love the consistency, Before and After Life as well. So we will put the links to all of these things that we've mentioned on the replay page and people can find them. But if they want to get in touch with you, they can go to beforeandafterlife.com.au, right?
Yes.
Amazing. So, so good. All right. So my last question for you before we wrap things up, is there anything else that you haven't said or that you'd like to reiterate or just a thought that you want to leave us with today?
I think inviting grief to the table enables us to come into relationship with what hurts and is hard. It helps us think about integrating grief and death into life so it becomes normalizing, you know, it normalized to feel the edges of our humanity, and it enables us to praise the natural world and each other, and it brings us back into presence and connection with the wider filaments of the world. And I think the final thing would be, please do your end of life paperwork. Please have essential conversations and create small microcosms of grief communities so that you can contain each other.
Thank you for making what can be an awkward topic actually quite beautiful today. Thank you, Emma, for joining us today, Emma Beattie, and thank you everyone for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.